Good morning, everyone. I'll take only two questions, please. Let me say something that, to make myself clear so no one thinks I'm some kind of a radical liberal ready to change everything in the church, you know. There is a good reason why the church has a typikon, a book of regulations and rubrics. And the typikon is not meant to strangle worship or to strangle creativity. It is there in order to do at least three things. The first is that the typikon tries to regulate worship so that we are always have an orderly worship. And from the earliest times, even within the New Testament, and the earliest documents speak to us about the church's orderly worship. Second, the typikon, again from antiquity, says that worship must have recognizable standards. Even as there were variations and variety, there was within a community, a large community, recognizable standards. And that is the same to this day. When you walk into an Orthodox church, you are not surprised with the worship of the church. There may be local customs, and I don't mean local customs in your town, but local customs in a particular area. That's what sometimes confounds some of us who have not grown up in the church, because our churches in America were established for the greater part by immigration. And the people that came to these shores came from various parts of the world and from various parts of a particular country. And each of these areas had their own little local customs that did not do any damage to the core of the worship. But when they came to this land and they established the parish, they did what they did back home. But nonetheless, it was still recognizable Orthodox worship. Whether it was the way the church is built, the way the church is arranged, how the worship is conducted, etc. So order and standards. And perhaps the most important aspect of the typikon is to say to every single member of the community, first to the priest himself, even to a bishop, and to all other orders of the church, and even to the laity, this worship is not yours. It belongs to the church. So therefore, it is not up to me to say, well, I like this, I don't like that. We don't create our own worship. The worship of the church is the church's worship, forged through ages. So we need, above all, as celebrants, to honor the worship of the church, to study it, to know it well, to absorb the ethos of the worship, and especially to love the worship, and to love the Lord through whom we give praises through our worship. More importantly, to have this idea in mind, why we need to know the worship and love it and understand it. Because this worship in the church is initiated by God. We are responding to his presence in our midst. And therefore, the worship of the church is a window unto another reality. That's why sometimes it is so extremely difficult to make changes because of this deep respect and awe for what we have received. Nonetheless, if we are students of liturgy and lovers of liturgy, then we cannot also not recognize that liturgy is like the church, a living organism. It's something alive. People change, cultures change, emphases change. And so we have to be responsible and responsive to particular situations in our time and age. Hence, as I think I mentioned before and I say again, those who love the liturgy of the church also agonize over the liturgy of the church. They are concerned that it is effectively communicating the message, the ethos, the phronema of the church. And so those who agonize over these questions sit with their fellow priests, together with their bishop, and speak about these issues and seek to find ways to make the worship relevant to the life of the people worshiping today. But to do so not as an individual who has all the answers to everything, but in the company of fellow presbyters under the guidance and supervision of the bishop, who is charged to maintain the unity of the faith and the good order of the church. Otherwise, we'd be in chaos. Everyone would do whatever they please. That's not orthodoxy. And a word to both the cradle Orthodox and to those convert Orthodox who are no longer converts, they're brothers and sisters in the Lord. I dislike, always dislike, when I'm introduced to somebody, say, this is so-and-so, he's a convert. He was a convert, you know, I don't know, an hour ago, 10 years ago. Why, he's still a convert? He's a member of the faith community. He is a brother. Amen. But when we come into the church, a cradle Orthodox who all of a sudden is inspired by the Spirit, or a convert who comes in, I'm going to show these guys what to do. I got the answers. I'm going to come into the church, the cradle Orthodox who's recently inspired, and the convert, these guys don't know anything. I'm going to go in there and shake the place up. That's a wrong attitude. It's like someone coming into your house. You welcome someone into your home with all the generosity of your soul, and the guy comes in and says, you know, I don't like the furniture arrangement here, and I don't like the food you serve. I don't particularly care the way you do things. Why don't we change these things? I got the answers to everything. That's why the typikon is so essential. To preserve order, to preserve recognizable standards, and to indicate clearly to everyone that the worship of the church is the church's worship. Not just in California or in the United States, but throughout the world. Thank you. Now, are there any questions from the things that we've said before in these past couple of days? Does anyone have any questions that need to be thought about? Father Mark.
A new topic.
They stole one of my microphones.
You said you would say something about the time of liturgy, and I wondered if you would say a few words on evening liturgies, the various circumstances the church has, evening liturgies, and all the things that are involved in that kind of thing, if you would.
No, I said a number of issues that could be talked about. And I raised the issue of the time of the liturgy. In fact, it pertains also to the tipica and all that stuff, and also to evening liturgies. I have a bad habit of giving long-winded answers. So please forgive me, all right? Let me begin first with this. From all indications that we have from the scriptures and from the early tradition of the church, the original Eucharistic assembly was an evening service. We get this from the Gospels. If you read the Gospels and St. Paul's 1 Corinthians that describe and refer to the Last Supper, you notice that the description in each of these four, three in the Synoptic Gospels and St. Paul, and some things that are said in the Acts of the Apostles, that the community gathered in the evening. And in the evening was also the celebration of the Eucharistic service. By the end of the first century, early part of the second century, sometime between 90 and 110 AD, there is a radical change in the celebration of the Eucharist. It is now taken out of the context of the evening gathering of the community and is pushed into the early morning hours. And the evening remains as a gathering for instruction and for fellowship with the agape meals. If you notice the descriptions of the Last Supper in the Synoptic Gospels and at St. Paul, you recognize that there are these little details that indicate not only how the Last Supper was conducted, but how the early Christian community served and celebrated the Eucharist. When you read St. Paul, which is the earliest account in 1 Corinthians, during the meal, or rather at the beginning of the meal, there is the consecration, and if we'll use our words now, consecration and the distribution of the bread. After the meal, you find the distribution of the cup. When you read the synoptics, Matthew and Mark, these two separate celebrations, bread and wine, now have been combined into one. Matthew and Mark say that within the meal, the Lord took the bread and took the cup, without saying exactly when, but within the context of the meal, within the meal. When you read Luke, or at least you could read Luke this way, the option to read it that way, that after the meal, this single component came, not within the meal, but after the meal, the giving of the bread and the cup. The sources of the last part of the first century and the beginning of the second century, we have a radical change. The Eucharist moves to an early morning celebration. Why? Probably because of the abuses that were occurring at the agape meals. St. Paul makes reference to them already. Also, perhaps because they wanted to separate themselves from the pagan practices of the collegia, the unions that would meet at the craftsmen, that would meet at evening services and carouse. And they did not, the early Christians, they'd want any part of that, especially coming from the pagan culture. So where to move it? Move it to the early morning, which was a prayer time in the Hebrew tradition. But the earliest celebration or scheme for the celebration of the divine liturgy is the evening. That's why the major feasts of the church, starting with Pascha, and what happens at Pascha is imitated for Christmas and Theophany. The chief celebration of these great feasts of the church is a vesperal liturgy, a vesperal celebration of the Eucharist. That's the most ancient tradition. Now, by moving the meal, the Eucharist, from the evening to the morning, we have an added feature that comes into play, the Eucharistic fast. After this transition to the early morning hour, we have the beginning and the establishment of the Eucharistic fast, to eat nothing before the celebration of the Eucharist. Why? Because in the pious tradition of Judaism, of the Jews, remembering now that the first Christians were Jews, especially, they would not eat until after the morning prayer. So that tradition created the Eucharistic fast, which we maintain to this day. By the time of the Peace of Constantine, there is now another change in the celebration, the time of the celebration of the Eucharist. And why the very early morning hours? Because it was the most free time that free men and slaves could gather. Because it was not work time yet. And remember that for at least another century, we only have one Eucharistic celebration, as Justin the Martyr tells us, for town and city folk, one. So they'd have to gather from all parts of the town and city to gather together, and the very, very early morning hours gave them that opportunity for that gathering. With the Peace of Constantine, there is now another change to the third hour of the morning, meaning around 9 a.m. And there is now given a reason for that, that the celebration of the Eucharist at the third hour of the morning coincides with what? From the Book of Acts, with the event of Pentecost. So this is the appropriate hour. Now, very quickly, because this long-winded answer, comes the monastic typikon. And the monastic typikon, as it evolves and comes into play, the notion is now changed in monastic communities. The divine liturgy has to be the last service of the day to coincide with the 12th hour, the sixth hour, noontime, or close to noontime. Why? The crucifixion. And so now, because of the growing sense that the Eucharist is also a sacrifice, it fits in with that notion. So that's why we have two traditions that coexist in the church and have coexisted. The emphasis that we still follow within the older tradition, Constantinople, Antioch, Alexandria, with the retention of the cathedral office mentality, versus the Slavic churches, which adopted, like all the other churches, but they retained the monastic typikon of St. Savas to also function with the celebration of the Divine Liturgy. Father Patrick said yesterday very correctly that the Divine Liturgy is not part of the daily cycle of worship. It has nothing to do with the daily cycle of worship. Hence, it could be celebrated in the evening, it could be celebrated in the day. However, within a period of time when fasting became such an important issue, confusing the Eucharistic fast with the ascetic fast, it became a kind of, what's the word you would use? I can't think of the word right now. That you cannot celebrate the Divine Liturgy in the evening. It's impossible. It has to be always at some morning hour. And for the longest time, that has created huge problems because it makes our worship irrational. As we mentioned the other day, which is especially prevalent in our Holy Week, the inversion of time. Evening services in the morning, morning services in the evening, and everybody gets confused. We are celebrating the crucifixion Thursday night, and we teach everybody that Jesus was crucified on Friday. The Greeks have a terrible, I don't know, maybe the Antiochians have the same situation, what they call the vigil of Great Saturday, which is celebrated now by all the churches, when? Saturday morning, which is the only day in the entire year that has no liturgy. Saturday is a liturgical day. Saturday also is not a fast day, as is Sunday, in honor of the old Sabbath. And traditionally, we are required as priests, and we don't do it for centuries now, every Saturday requires the celebration of a divine liturgy. And it is the only day that there's, except for Holy Saturday. Holy Saturday has no liturgy, and Holy Saturday is the strictest of the fast days. Now, what do you do with that day when on Saturday morning you celebrate the festal vigil of Pascha with all the joy that that service has on Saturday morning? And then you continue, after you've had this wondrous celebration, you continue the fast. And everything, well, parts of the whole service refer to evening, to the setting of the sun and all these other things. The Greeks call this Saturday morning service the first resurrection. Well, I didn't know there was a second one. What do the Arabs call it? Do they have such a...
No, we don't have... we call it the Saturday of the light. The Saturday of the light.
Of the light, because of the Jerusalem that received. And the light, by the way, in Jerusalem is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, isn't it? Right. It's not at midnight or whatever. Now, so therefore, the divine liturgy, at least in the Greek Archdiocese in America, and much later in Greece, it began to be applied, at the request of many of the clergy who were now seeing this need for some kind of renewal and approach to the liturgy, began to ask, and our Archdiocese in the early 70s gave permission to the clergy to celebrate pre-sanctified liturgies in the evening, which is the normal thing. Before that, no liturgy was ever celebrated in the evening. It was thought improper because there was no fast, or unless you fasted the entire day. But responding to the needs of the people, the second thing the Archdiocese did, and I remember this distinctly, in 1974, again through the requests of some of the clergy who were concerned to bring the liturgy to a greater mass of people than would attend a morning liturgy, to have evening liturgies on the day before a great feast. If 10 people would show up in the morning, perhaps 40 people would show up in the evening. So permission was given for that celebration, with certain requirements that were for the priest and for the people, those who were preparing to receive communion. That has become the standard in our church in the Greek Archdiocese today. I don't know what it occurs in the Antiochian. So the possibility of celebrating evening liturgies is there, with certain requirements. For example, if you were at the request that you may have to present to your bishop to celebrate the Feast of the Exaltation of the Cross, which is a major feast of the church, at an evening liturgy, you would do so, but with this difference: not on the eve of the feast, which is September 13th, but on the eve of the 14th, because the 14th itself is a fast day. So you would conclude the fast with a celebration of a complete divine liturgy, not a pre-sanctified, but a complete divine liturgy. In fact, in some of the early documents, the Feast of the Cross was celebrated with a liturgy in the evening because of the fast. The other feasts, because we are in the day, we begin the day in the evening and end it, as Father Patrick said yesterday, with the ninth hour, which completes the day. So you're celebrating the feast of Saint Ignatius, instead of which is the 20th of December, right? You would celebrate it December 19th in the evening, with a Vesper service, as I think it should be, a Vesper service up and through the entrance of the Vespers, and from there, from the Trisagion for the rest of the liturgy. So that the antiphons and the entrance belong to the Vespers, and the rest belongs to the celebration of the divine liturgy, from the Trisagion prayer and thereafter. On the Feast of the Annunciation, because this question was posed to me yesterday, the Feast of the Annunciation is a great feast of the church, and the only great feast of the church that the forefeast and the afterfeast are so limited to one day forefeast to one day afterfeast. This celebration of the Annunciation is a celebration. And therefore, in the morning of the March 25th, we have the Orthros and the Divine Liturgy. Here, since I'm speaking on the Annunciation, may I add a note about the Akathist hymn? If you notice, the Akathist hymn is set for what? Where do we read the Akathist hymn? No, in the Triodion. Where do you find the Akathist hymn? Which morning? The fifth Saturday of Lent. And the Slavic churches to this day celebrate the Akathist hymn only on the fifth Saturday of Lent. Yes. So, ingeniously, the East, I don't know exactly when this began, in order to extend the Feast of the Annunciation, took the Akathist hymn, broke it into four parts, so that every Friday of the Lenten season, we would celebrate a portion of the Akathist hymn in the context of a small compline. Now, the Akathist hymn is the true Akathist hymn is the Kondakion, with its prelude and its 24 stanzas, to which has been added the canon, a canon. You have two different genres of music there. The first is the canon, the Kondakion, and the second is the canon. This canon and this Kondakion have been added to a small compline. And the small compline is interrupted at one point with the canon and a part of 1/4 of the Akathist hymn. The Akathist hymn, if you read the initial prelude, which we say only on the fifth Friday, makes reference to the Annunciation. And the whole Akathist begins with the Annunciation. So the 12 first stanzas of the Akathist hymn refer to the historical event of the Annunciation, and the narratives of the Gospel pertaining to the infancy narratives in the Gospel of our Lord, which include the birth of the Lord, the visitation of the Magi, the visitation of the shepherds, the flight to Egypt, and all that. It gives an historical perspective to it, and the last 12 stanzas of the Akathist are a theological reflection on those events. And in between, the hails to the Theotokos. The ingenious thing of doing this is to extend the celebration of the Annunciation and the forefeast and afterfeast of the Annunciation, depending when it falls. Practical reasons required this movement in order to protect the sacredness of the Eucharistic celebration. I've never come across anything of that sort. Of course, you also hear to your thing, but not so much about, you're correct. I don't remember the exact quotation now, but if you read Justin Martyr, he says, we gather on Sunday, the day of the sun, he says, because that's the pagan. And we do so because it is the day also on which Jesus was risen from the dead. Keep in mind that the early Christians is a Jewish community. And the beginning of the celebration of the Sabbath begins on Friday night with a meal. And so the Jewish concept, you begin the celebration of a feast with a meal on the evening before. That's why even now, the main Paschal celebration is not what we turned into now, but the vigil. And how do we know that? Because what is attached to the vigil? What liturgy? St. Basil. And we know that in Byzantium, St. Basil was the chief liturgy celebrated every Sunday and every major feast day. Yes, there is a connection to the resurrection, but the resurrection was celebrated even in an evening meal on Saturday. Was that a good, all right, Father? In Romania, in Greece, it's done early in the morning. At 5 o'clock, they begin the Orthros and then celebrate the Divine Liturgy.
Do they do it at midnight as well?
No. In Greece, as I recall, it starts sometime around 5 in the morning, and it's over by 8 o'clock in the morning. No, Christmas. I didn't know. I'm not aware of that. Those are local variations in customs, which are, acceptable. For example, you won't go to any Greek church and have a sensing, as you do, during the Trisagion at the beginning of the Orthros service. We don't do it. Is it wrong? or what you do, is it right? That's your custom? You do it. Where did it come from, though? That's the important thing. The Greeks have preserved that during Holy Week season, when we still read and intone the royal psalms of that first part of the Orthros. And we do not use the censer with the bells and the chain, but the hand censer called the kadzion. Why? That's what they use in monasteries, and that's where it came from. And why do we do it at that point? Because we stopped thinking that we should sense the entire church before we begin the service. So that sensing that is done at the beginning, before the beginning of the service, has been transposed to the time of the royal psalms. So you have continued this notion and idea that the church should be sensed before we begin the service, the first service of the day. Bravo! You continue to do it. We don't do it. Is it wrong? No. That is our custom. It is not a, how should I say, a something that would in some way transgress or undo the liturgy of the church.